Well, we'll be back in 1 Samuel tonight, starting in chapter 5. We did all of chapter 4 last week. My goal is to go through chapter 7, verse 1 today. This will finish this particular story as it is. And what we saw last week was the Jews, the Israeli people, went to war against the Philistines, as they live along the Mediterranean coast and inland a little ways. We're going to read about several cities tonight, but we need to understand not so much the topography, a little bit of the geography, and what we're really dealing with here. Very much like our Civil War, I've only been to a couple of the Civil War sites back in Philadelphia and some places in the Revolutionary War also. And, you know, it's not like war today when a guy sits in Maryland with a control and he's controlling a jet that's flying over, you know, Afghanistan, and he's got it controlling it in Maryland. And he says, okay, wipe out that town. And they drop enough bombs to wipe out a town of 200,000 people or whatever. It's not quite like that, what we're seeing here. When we see these cities, just put all of this in Delta County and say, you know, the king of Eckert went against the king of Cedar Ridge, and they ganged up on each other. And then the king of Hotchkiss came in to see if he could get some of the spoils. This is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with cities that are 5, 10 miles distant from each other, a couple of thousand people in each little burg. A far way to go on these conflicts in these chapters would be like from here to Crawford. That's almost unimaginable to them. And it's a whole different world than what we have in the United States. When I lived up in the canyon, it was 20 miles to Safeway. And when we were first starting Trace Diaz here, we brought some people and had some people stay at our house. And at that time, Walmart wasn't in Delta. And one lady was horrified that I would have to drive 40 or 45 miles to Walmart in Montrose. She could not imagine a world that didn't have a Walmart closer than 45 miles. It was just unthinkable. But to us, and these people are, you know, the wealthier ones have donkeys, but for the most part, they're foot soldiers. And so when we see these battles going on, and we're going to see, talk about the Temple of Dagon, where they have this figure of this god that they worship, it'd be like setting up, you know, a 6-foot statue in Orchard City Town Hall and calling that the Temple of Dagon or something like that. So we shouldn't be thinking Solomon's Temple and big cities of hundreds of thousands of people. When we went through Jonah and he went to Nineveh, that's different. Nineveh was a big city, 120,000 people, 4 or 5 days walk across it. We talked about the walls, the outer walls, the inner walls, run chariots around them, just like the walls around Babylon and stuff. That's not what we're dealing with here. We also talked about the Philistines, who live in an area that is now called Palestine, but it's always been belonged to the Jews since God gave it to Abraham. Before that, it was just agricultural land, and there were little towns, and the people generally were called Canaanites, and there were different family groups that broke down into different relations, but for the most part they were called Canaanites. The Philistines were a seafaring people out of the Aegean Sea, which is just a little jut of the Mediterranean up in the northern end of the Mediterranean, north and west. And so they came down onto the coast from across the Mediterranean and landed on the coast in an area that we now know as Gaza. And they lived along the coast, and they moved inland, some of them as much as 15 miles or so, had these little towns, and they accepted the god of the Canaanites that was there, which is Dagon, who in Canaanite literature is the father of Baal. When we see Baal in the Old Testament, that god Dagon is his dad. And the Philistines adapted it to their own use, and so they kept the torso of a man, but from the bottom down, it was a big fish. And so think in the Roman and Greek mythology, the Romans had The Greek had Poseidon, and the Romans named him, somebody help me with the sea god of the Romans, Neptune. So in Roman mythology, this god is Neptune, and in Greek mythology, it's Poseidon. And in this literature, which predates either the Greeks or the Romans, he's Dagon. And so that's what we're up against here. So we saw that battle last week, and initially the Jews were defeated. About 4,000 of them were defeated. And so they decided it must be because God wasn't with us. So they took the ark and took it to battle with them, which terrified the Philistines, because they knew the stories of the God of the Jews who brought them out of Egypt. They knew the stories of all the chaos that God brought into Egypt and destroyed their country, the 10 plagues and all the firstborn. And remember, I mentioned each of those plagues was against a different God of the Egyptian people. And the Philistines had heard these stories since they came onshore, just like the people of Jericho were terrified when Israel came. Well, Israel came against Jericho just 40 years after they came out of Egypt. We're talking 350 years now. So those stories are still enough to terrify the people. And one thing that I want to mention about that, when we're reading Old Testament history, and it is history, we need to understand how spiritually minded these people are. I run into people very often in different places in the public when I start talking to them. I say, "Well, I'm a pastor." And they say, "Oh, what church?" And I start telling them, you know, and they say, "Well, I'm a very spiritual person." I say, "What does that mean?" You know, I ask, "What does that mean? Do you believe in God?" I'm a spiritual person. You know, they kind of give you the whole Joel Osteen thing. You know, I believe what seems believable, man. I don't have a problem with that. And it doesn't mean anything, really. But the history of the Old Testament, these people had a vibrant relationship with their God, even if their God was just a piece of stone. They attributed everything to the gods because they couldn't understand, you know, thunder, fire, everything, the movement of the sea, the creatures that came out of the sea, for crying out loud, those are scary. So they attribute everything to their gods. And so they are a very spiritual-minded people. And so when the Jews come out, they just begin to bring all of the other religious things into theirs, and they incorporate it. Remember, I said the last several weeks, I've said, do not compromise. Whether it's been on Sunday morning or the afterburner or Wednesday night, do not compromise with the world. This is what always got the Jews in trouble, their whole history, even today. And so they said, well, it must be because we didn't have God with us, and they took the temple down there, and the Philistines were terrified, not the temple, the ark. And the Philistines were terrified because they knew they had brought the ark with them, and it was a beautiful thing. And they said, okay, this is it, man. Their God is something. We're gonna have to stand up like men and fight for this one. And they did, and they slaughtered them. And so they captured the ark. The Philistines did, and the Jews went home sorely beaten. Remember in this, we see at the chapter 4 that Eli died and his sons were killed in the battle and all that. So now you remember where we were last week. Okay, chapter 5, verse 1. When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod rose early in the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place, you know, because he can't stand up by himself, obviously. So they stand him up, and probably like our little Christmas trees, we say, okay, we better run a wire this time and wrap a wire around him, secure it to the wall so that he won't fall over again. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in the Ashdod, in the town of Ashdod to this day. So let's work through that a little bit. So when you go in this temple, and there are archaeological digs today from the Iron Age, where this is in the Iron Age, that period of Mesopotamian history that we attribute that to, with the development of all kinds of iron products. In their temple, whether how big it was or how small, depending on the size of the town or the number of people, they would build a little platform, just like we have for the drums at church. They put a little platform up there and stand their god on there so that the god is elevated above the floor of the people. That platform is the threshold. We think threshold is the door. Okay. Now, sometimes that was very close to the door. And they also had a threshold across the door that the doors would open inward, but they couldn't open outward because that threshold would stop them. But the threshold of the god was the little platform they built for him to be on. And they put the Ark of the Covenant there by Dagon. Dagon's taller. And so it's a picture that our God has defeated their God. That's why we defeated them. Our God is victorious. Yay! And so they come in the morning, their God's laying on the floor, face down in front of the Ark. Okay. Pardon? Yeah. And so that's a place of submission. So they feel like, well, I didn't feel any earthquake tremors, but something must have happened. The wind, who knows what, but caused him to tipple over. So they stood him back up and secured him. And the next day, and usually, the relics that we have today from reliefs that are carved into rock and different things like that, they would fashion these gods fully clothed except their head and hands, usually. And of course, this one has a fish tail. And so the hands and the face are all that's really exposed. They sometimes would have a crown on it. So when they come in the next day, after they stood him up and secured him good, he's fallen down, and his head and his hands are not broken off. They're cut off, because the hands would be secured to the arm with just they put a stick coming out of the arm and put the hand on there, drill a hole in it, like a dowel rod or something like that. And they could break, but they weren't. It says very specifically that his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. And so this is what often happened. We could go back in Judges and read about when they would take a king and cut off his thumbs and his great toes. And one of them said, 70 men, 70 other kings have I cut off their thumbs and their toes. Well, think about it. If you cut off a man's thumbs and his toes, you have severely handicapped that person in terms of eating or throwing a spear or holding a sword to fight with. And cut off their great toes,
Is that why they did it?
Yeah,
Well,
well,
I'm
it's the
curious.
first reason why they do it is it's an act of terrible, terrible humiliation. And the second is because you completely disable that person in that era. They don't have physical therapists, they don't have false toes. I mean, they're completely disabled if you don't have that thumb, if you're a soldier,
Balance of your butt.
and your great toe. I worked with a guy in the mine in Leadville that he limped. He was a generation ahead of me. I went to school with his kids, and I really liked him a lot. He was a great guy. And I said, "Do you mind me asking why you limp?" And he said, "Yep. When I was in the war, that'd be World War II, I got my toe blown off, my great toe." And he says, "Here it is, 30 years later at that time, and I still limp, because without a great toe, it's pretty hard to walk like a normal person does. Forget running. You're not going to run. You're not going to jump for basketball anymore." That's just how important those digits are, So that's how they found him the next day. And when they went in and found him with his head and his hands cut off and his torso laying down there at the foot of the ark, they realized they were up against something they wish they weren't up against. They began to realize that. And so they said in verse 6, well, the reason they didn't stand on the threshold anymore, step on it, because when you would walk in there, the first thing you would step on is probably his hand or his head. As you go across the threshold of the door and into that, then you're going to step on the hand or the head. And so
It had been broken.
that's terrible, because now, even though your God has been profaned before you, now you're stepping on him. And so now they're really up against it. And so they refuse even to step on the threshold anymore, because they hold those things in high honor, you know. So the hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And the word for tumors in the Greek is not specific enough to know exactly what kind of tumors they are, but there's two clues. When they get ready to send the ark back, they send with it some little offerings, which are either mice or rats and grain. And there's, because the rats was probably a rat infestation brought on by God that was eating their grain, which is, you know, that's bad news, because they don't have a Walmart. It's more than 40 miles. It's like 40 centuries. And so that gives us a clue as to what it means the hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod. And, you know, the reason when I've had some people once, well, not very many who live around here, but people that move from the cities, and they think prairie dogs are just the cutest little things in the world. And they're horrified that I would go out and blast every single one of them I can. When I first moved to Delta County, and in whatever year that was, 94, there was a gal right out here in Orchard, Peach Valley, that died from bubonic plague, from the fleas from a prairie dog that got on her cat and got on her, and she died from bubonic plague. And rats and mice and prairie dogs can carry bubonic plague. And so the other thing that this word tumors can mean in some of the periodic literature, it sounds like they have a bad case of hemorrhoids caused from something, hemorrhoidal type of tumors. Okay. But the hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and God terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. So that would be like saying Orchard City instead of Eckert. Okay. Ashdod and its territory, Orchard City instead of just Eckert. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon, our God." So instead of thinking, you know, if this really is the real God,
Maybe we ought to
yeah,
switch.
maybe we should see if we can make a deal with them Jews. But no, they said, "Let's just get rid of him." Because to them, gods were territorial. Okay. There was no such thing as a god of the whole world. Well, I mean, their Dagon got close, because he was the god of the seas, and he was also the father of Baal. And so he got close, just like Zeus, you know, is, and Jupiter, the same one, Greek and Roman. He was the chief of gods. But it was usually like Dagon is a territorial god. And so the God of the Jews came in here and defeated our God, so let's just send him back to his territory, and everything can go back to normal. And Dagon, our God, can continue to, you know, bless and infirm us and whatever. So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines. That would be five, because there's five primary Philistine cities in this small region that we would call Delta County, or thereabouts. It wouldn't even be as big as Delta in Montrose County, but, you know, so there was five of them, each the chief of a main city. And so they called all of the lords of the Philistines together and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" They answered, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath." Well, I don't know who the chief of Gath was, but I can't imagine he was very happy with that. So instead of sending it back to the Jews, they sent it to the city of Gath. So they brought the ark of the God of Israel there, but after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city, causing a very great panic, And he afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. And it's very distinctly men. And it's worse than it was in Ashdod. The affliction that they received was worse than the one at Ashdod, and causing a very great panic in the city. And so there they are with the ark, and the same thing is happening there, except worse, more profound.
Let's move it on.
So they sent the ark to Ekron. But as soon as the ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out. So this was done, you know, probably against their will.
So they had heard about that
Yeah.
from the other people.
Yes. Exactly, how the men are dying and sick and
And now you want us to.
infestations of rats and mice, and they're eating all their wheat stores. Fred?
I was going to say, when David moved the ark with his people, and what happened to that one man
Right.
that went to
Touch
steady
it.
the things?
Yep.
And I was wondering
Well,
about
we're going to
that.
get into that later. Don't jump the ship.
But
Don't jump the ship, Fred. We're going to talk about that later, Fred. Don't jump the ship. Please.
that's been going in my mind too.
Not only is that, you know, 100 years later, but there's more of that in these couple of chapters, and I have a deliberate point to show on that.
Okay.
So don't jump the ship on me. As
Yeah.
soon as the Ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, "They have brought around to us the Ark of the God of Israel to kill us and our people." So now what do we see? We see that the Philistines are beginning to fight against themselves. They brought it to us to kill us. The ark of the God of Israel to kill us and our people. So they sent, therefore, and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel and let it return to its own place that it may not kill us and our people." For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors. And the cry of the city went up to heaven.
The beginning of cancer.
So they began to petition heaven, even in their ignorance, because they recognized at this point there isn't any place that's safe from the Ark of the Covenant of God. Okay? And so they got together and decided to send it back to the Israeli people. So the Ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months, is how long this was going on. Okay.
That's not very bad.
And the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, "What shall we do at the Ark of the priests and the diviners are different people. It would be like saying the priests and the prophets. The priests are the ones who stood between God and man, so between Dagon and man. They were the ones that officiated in the little temples and things like that. The diviners were the ones that they called in to say, "What do the gods say? What shall we do?" And they had different methods of divination. You can see some of them in the Old Testament as we read through different parts of it. I'll give you two for examples. Well, in Israel, they had the Urim and the Thummim, remember? And the chief priest would have that, and they would go ask, and somehow it's usually decided, it's usually going for a yes or no answer. Today we would think of a Ouija board, okay, in a demonic sense and dealing with false gods. But with the high priest of Israel, they did have that instrument that would help them understand what the Lord was wanting them to do, and nobody really knows how that works, how it worked, or exactly what it was. So in the older Testament days, in the Canaanite religious traditions, they would cut open a lamb, usually, or any animal, but they usually would choose a lamb, and they would pull out its liver and examine the liver, and the liver would tell them the will of God. Or another alternate was the smaller intestines. And they could tell from the intestines, the diviners would say, "Okay, God says yes," or "God says no." And how they did that, we don't know. We just have examples of it in their literature, but it doesn't go into enough detail with the specifics of how they could tell from the liver or the small intestines what the will of God was. And I am frankly delighted that they've moved away from that type of type of understanding the will, the word and will of God. So the Ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months, and you say, well, that's not very long. It is if it's just death and destruction and all of your food for next year is being destroyed. That's a long time for them. You know, talk about these fires in California. You know, we're hoping those go away in a couple of days. If that was 7 months,
all of it'd be,
you know, the flood was a year. They were on the boat for a year, but it only rained for 40 days and 40 nights. So 7 months is quite a long time for this kind of panic and plague. So they called together the priests and the diviners. What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us with what we shall send it to its place. So they said, if you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means, return him a guilt offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand does not turn away from you. And they said, well, what is the guilt offering that we shall return it? We don't know about this God of Israel. Does he like human hearts? Is it supposed to be a child sacrifice, or what is this going to be here? So what is the guilt offering? And they answered, 5 golden tumors, you know, a piece of gold fashioned in the image of what their tumors look like. And then, and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines. So one golden image of a tumor from each of the captains of the 5 cities, and one golden image of a mouse or a rat from each of the captains of the 5 cities. And according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for the same plague was on all of you and on your lords. So you must make images of your tumors and images of your mice that ravage the land and give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from off you and your gods and your land. I mean, you can understand, perhaps he'll lighten his hand off of you, but off of your gods. They really do believe these gods have some kind of power and authority, just stick figures, rocks that they carve. You know, Isaiah says they go out into the forest, they cut down a tree, and they cut it in 3 pieces. And one of it, they, you know, cut into firewood and heat their home. And one of those pieces, they fashion into a god and plate it with gold and put up and worship it. And, you know, they put it in the fire.
Same thing.
And they give it some kind of power and authority over their lives. They really believe that.
A mouse dipped in a gold.
So verse 6, why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? 300 years, they're still remembering those stories of Pharaoh and the Egyptians. And they knew it was because they had hardened their heart against God. They at least knew part of the truth of the story. After he had dealt severely with them, the Pharaoh and Egyptians, did they not send the people away and they departed? Now then, take and prepare a new cart and 2 milk cows on which there has never come a yoke, and yoke the cows to the cart. Take their calves home away from them. So you have 2 cows that have never been under a yoke. They have brand new calves. And if you put them to a cart, number one, they're not going to know how to pull the cart, especially together. You have to train oxen and horses and stuff to pull a cart working together. And when you take a mama away from her calf for long enough and her milk bag gets pretty big, she's going to go find some calf or some something, even if it's just the guy in the shed that's milking her for home milk. I need some help here. Yoke the cows to the cart, but take their calves home away from them, and take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart and put it in a box at its side. Put in the box at its side the figures of gold, which you are returning to him as a guilt offering. Then send it off and let it go its way and watch. If it goes up on the way to its own land, to Beth Shemesh, then it is he who has done this great harm. But if not, then we'll know that it's not his hand that struck us. It just happened to us by coinkydink, by chance. Okay. So, well, that's a pretty smart test, because if the cows, if they're not being directed by the hand of God, so they're sending it up this road that goes up a small grade back to the town of the Jews. And I've read different accounts, depending on, they have different archaeological digs over there, and depending on where they think it exactly was, somewhere between 5 and 11 miles. Okay, so they're sending it from here up to Tracy's house. See if the cow can get there by itself. The men did so and took two milk cows and yoked them to the cart and shut their calves at home. And they put the ark of the Lord on the cart and box with the golden mice and the images of their tumors. Cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway, lowing as they went. Hi ho, hi ho. They turned neither to the right nor to the left, and the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. They wanted to see and make sure. Now, the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. So it's May and June right now. So the mice were there eating all their wheat as they were headed into winter. That's a bad deal, the 7 months, because the wheat harvest in that place is May and June. So this is when the cart is coming back. They were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. And when they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, they rejoiced to see it. The cart came into the field of Joshua Beth Shemesh and stopped there. So the cows just pulled it to that field and stopped and just waited for somebody to come and unload it, let them get back to their own home. A great stone was there, and they split up the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord, the men of Beth Shemesh. So they took the wood of the cart, split it up, made an altar, sacrificed the cows as a thanksgiving offering for getting the ark back. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was beside it, in which were the golden figures, and set them upon the great stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices on that day to the Lord. And when the five lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned that day to Ekron. And they returned smarter than what they left. These are the golden tumors that the Philistines returned as a guilt offering to the Lord. One for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, one for Ekron. And the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both fortified cities and unwalled villages, the great stone beside which they set down the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day being whenever this was composed, in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. Now, so they have the ark back. The Philistines have gone back home. They're happy. They can start healing again. And it's time for wheat harvest, so they're not going to starve to death and die. And the Jews have their ark back. It's not back where it should be with the tabernacle, and the scriptures don't tell us why. There are several theories why. Remember, Eli was at the tabernacle, and it could be that the Philistines destroyed Shiloh, the town, and they destroyed the tabernacle. But that goes against when we read of what David, when looking forward to what Fred was saying, when David brought the ark back, there was a tabernacle. And Samuel continued at a tabernacle. So we don't really know where the tabernacle was, but for a season, they left the ark here. And he struck, verse 19, and he, being God, struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. Now, this is really quite a picture here, chapter 6, verse 19. Let me get.
They looked into the ark, so that means they had to touch on.
Well, I'm going to talk about that a little bit. It says, and he struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. Okay, and some of the other translations say they looked into the ark, but that's not what the scripture says. They just looked at it, gazed at it. And we're talking about different texts of the Old Testament here. We have the Masoretic text and then the different texts from the Septuagint stuff. One of the Septuagint texts says that the people that were struck down looked away from the ark and they didn't honor it. They thought, no big deal. They didn't honor it, so God struck them. One of the Septuagint says that, but that's not very likely, because they would have been gobstruck if they saw that thing coming into their town, all of them. The others just, they looked at it with a lot of curiosity, not necessarily reverentially, okay? And curiosity enough that, you know, we need maybe investigate this, but the scripture never says they did investigate it. And then the other thing is the number. For example, I'm going to read to you the Holman Christian Standard. God struck down the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked inside the ark of the Lord. So the Christian Standard says they looked inside, but there's no Hebrew correlation with that. That's just an interpretation on the part of the people who are translating the Bible. Because there was another time when they looked in the ark and were killed, but it doesn't say that here. They just looked at it. And he struck down 70 men out of 50,000 men. 70 men out of 50,000 men. The people mourned because the Lord struck them with a great slaughter. So they're saying, the Holman Christian is saying, that there was 50,000 men and God killed 70 of those 50,000. The New King James, then he struck the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck 50,070 men of the people, and the people lamented because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. The New American Standard is very similar. Now, he fatally struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck 50,070 men among the people, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. And the NET Bible is very similar to that. So, did he kill 70, or did he kill 70 out of 50,000, or did he kill 50,070 men? Fred?
It's hard to believe that when you're 50,000. I was just thinking about the population of that area.
That's a good observation. And it just got there. It's not like they had sent out a telegram 5 days.
Yeah.
But that's a good observation. It's highly unlikely. It's very unlikely. It's that there was that many people there at all in the region. They couldn't have got there that fast, and they certainly don't have that many people living there. Okay, so that's a good observation from Fred. The Hebrew, like the Greek, the Hebrew doesn't have numbers like we do, cardinal numbers. The letters of the alphabet are the numbers. We have a separate whole number system. So the letters of the alphabet are the numbers. And this is the only place in the Hebrew Bible where it gives a number like this. So in Spanish, if I was going to say 22... you would say 22, 20 and 2, okay? And it's the same way in English, 22. And in the Hebrew, in this text, let me read it to you. Take me just a second here. I've got to... What it says is, this is would be a literal reading of it. And he, God, smote among the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked at the ark of Jehovah, and smote among the people 70 men, 50,000 men, period. That's the only place in Hebrew that a number is ever constructed that way. 70 men, 50,000 men. And some of my favorite commentators of the Old Testament, the 19th century Germans, Kyle and Delitzsch, discuss it this way. In this statement of numbers, we are not only struck by the fact that the 70 stands before the 50,000, which is very unusual, is the only place it ever happens, but even more by the omission of the copula vav, that's a letter. It doesn't even say 70 and 50,000. It just says 70 before 70 men, 50,000 men. So when I told you 22 in Spanish, when we say 22, it'd be 20. And it sounds so fast that you think it's just two words, 20 dos. But it's actually 20. Then the little word for and, which is just their Y, E, dos, 20 dos. But it just sounds like 20, but it's 20 e dos, 20 and 2. And the Hebrew usually constructs numbers the same exact way. So they would say 50,000 and 70. Instead, here it just says 70 men, 50,000 men. And so they have the omission of the copula, the letter, it's the W, it's a vowel, before the second number, which is altogether unparalleled. When in addition to this, we notice that 50,000 men could not possibly live either in or around Beth Shemesh, and that we cannot conceive of any extraordinary gathering having taken place out of the whole land or even from the immediate neighborhood. And then also the words, and he gives the Hebrew words there, are wanting in several Hebrew manuscripts. So Josephus, in his history of the Jews, he was contemporary, first century. In his history of the Jews, he was commissioned by the Roman government to write a history of the Jews. He recounts this battle as the Lord killed 70 men. So the 50,000 could have been from a marginal note in the margin of the manuscript that gets added into the Bible. There's places in the New Testament where I can show you that with different manuscripts, something from one of the copyists made a note in the margin, you know, after it's copied another time, the other copyist says, well, that should have been over here, and it's moved into the manuscript. And this doesn't affect the inspiration of scriptures at all. But, you know, one of the best observations, what Fred said, is it's not possible that there were 50,000 men there. It's just not. They didn't have that kind of population at that place, at that time. And so verse 19 ought to read then, and he struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. And however they looked at the ark, these men, was disturbing to the Lord. They did not look in the ark, they just looked upon it. And however they looked at it was disturbing to the Lord. And he struck 70 of them, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great blow. Then the men of Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom shall he go up away from us? In other words, they're asking, where can we send this ark? The Jews.
Jews next.
So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath Jearim, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it to you. Chapter 7. And the men of Kiriath Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab on the hill. And they consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge of the ark of the Lord. So Kiriath Jearim was not one of the cities where the priests had the priests had certain cities. This was not one of them. But Abinadab was a priest, and his son Eleazar was a priest. And so they consecrated a priest to look after the ark and take charge of it. And the thing that I wanted to mention about this that I think we shouldn't miss, we expect God to treat the pagans poorly when they mistreat the ark, especially when they put it in the temple of their God and say, look, our God defeated your God. We expect God to treat them poorly. But when the ark comes back home to Israeli territory, and some of the men of that city look at the ark in such a way that does not please God, the man that touched the ark when David was bringing it back was perfectly innocent in what he did. We would think they were bringing it on a cart, an ox cart, just like this, which they were not permitted to do. The ark was to be carried with the sticks that went through the holes on the side by the priests. It was never to be put on an ox or an ox cart. The Philistines didn't know that, but David knew that. And so he was bringing the ark back to Jerusalem, and on an ox cart, which violated the law, And when the ox and the cart stumbled, the man there, a priest,
Uzziah.
Put his arms up.
Uzziah. Yeah.
Uzzah, not Uzziah, just Uzzah.
Yeah.
Put his hands to stabilize it so it wouldn't fall on the dirt. And God torched him. Man, he died right there. Bam. And David really got hacked. David was mad. And so he just took the ark to the nearest parking lot and stuck, you know, left it there for a while. I mean, figured out that, you know, it was David's fault and it was Uzzah's fault. As a priest, he knew better, and as King, David knew better than to do that. So the point I want to make with that is the same as, remember Aaron's sons, the very first time when they set up the tabernacle and they were consecrating everything, and Aaron's two sons got all caught up in the work of ministry, and oh boy, we're going to be priests no more, making mud bricks in Egypt and all that kind of stuff. And they offered a strange fire. That's all it says. Fire that God had not approved. They made some kind of gesture with the censers and things that God had not approved, and lightning came out of the ark and toasted them. I mean, they were crispy critters, and they had to call some of the first cousins to haul them away. And God told, through Moses, God told Aaron, don't you even shed a tear over these boys. Don't even shed a tear over them. And so he couldn't. God is very concerned about his holiness. And when we're not concerned about it, then we're in the wrong, not God. And this is why I repeat virtually every week in one of our lessons or another, the main thing that we need to know is who is God. And if we don't worship his holiness, and I mean worship it, then we're on thin ice. Okay? And what do I mean by worship his holiness? How do you do that? Well, you be careful the songs you sing, the lyrics of the songs. I was just looking at a man on YouTube the other day that I more or less respect, and you people would know him right away if I mentioned his name. But he doesn't have a problem singing, you know, all the latest from Hillsong and Bethel and Elevation Worship, the most blasphemous songs that have ever been written. And he doesn't have a problem with that. And I said, this doesn't make sense. This is an oxymoron coming from you. But, you know, it is. And I think that we need to be really, really very careful how we do that. This is one of the reasons why I put that sign on the coffee machine at church. Please, at 10 o'clock, when the service starts, if you need coffee during the service, have it and take your chair. And for the whole time that we're in there, from 10 till 12 or whatever, be polite and respectful to God. Don't be going in and out of the door six or seven times to get another cookie or get another cup of coffee. I understand sometimes people, I got to go to the bathroom and I got to go bad. I understand that. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about general demeanor during a worship service. About what?
Reverence.
Reverence, yeah. Thank you. General reverence. For the pastor, forget the pastor. He's just one of the people there who came to worship God. That's it. We are there for that purpose, to worship God. Our fellowship is a means of worshiping God because we greet one another in the name of Jesus. And that's why we need to be very, 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 very careful about our conversation. That's really the time to practice hard. Do not let any unwholesome word come out of your mouth, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their need, that it may benefit those who listen. And try not to do that while we're singing, because our singing is to God. Mm-hmm. And if people are walking around, you know, like I said in church the other day, what that tells me from the pulpit, when I see that going on, that person who's going over there to talk thinks that whatever they have to say is more important than that person singing praise to God. And it is not. I don't care what it is. It's not more important than another person singing praise and honor to God.
And they miss the message.
Yeah, and then during the message, you miss the message of the song,
mm-hmm.
everything. And it's, you know, and I don't say it because I want to be an ogre or anything like that. I say it because, do you realize what we're trying to do here? Worship God. Maybe I should make an artifact like this Ark of the Covenant, and, you know, bring angels and things like that and put it up there and stand behind that as the pulpit, you know. But in a week or two, they'd get used to that. And we have to check our behavior, because God does not tolerate disrespecting his holiness. He just doesn't. And we're sinners, and we do that different ways, and it's just not for Sunday. We are called to be priests of the Most High God. That's what the New Testament teaches us. It's not a priestly line anymore, like Aaron's line. That doesn't happen. In the New Testament, everybody who believes in the Lord Jesus for the forgiveness of their sins is a priest. And Peter says we're actually building blocks in the temple. We are the temple of God. So we need to be aware of that. And these guys, you know, 70 of them, whatever, however they looked at the ark, man, God zapped them into eternity. The same way with Uzzah and the sons of Aaron. He doesn't normally do that today, but remember Acts chapter 5, Ananias and Sapphira. Barnabas had some property and he sold it and gave the money to the church because there were people in the church that were hungry and didn't have the food and stuff that they needed. And so the church thanked Barnabas, and he's like, you know what? It's God's. But Ananias and Sapphira had some properties. They were real estate developers. So they sold a property and gave half the money to the church and told the church, we sold this property and here's all the money. But they only gave half, but they lied. They lied to the church. No, they lied to God. And so when they came back, Peter said, how much did you sell that property for? Did you give it all to the church? Yeah, you betcha. You want to give me a letter of thanks or what kind of commendation I get? Here's your commendation. Drop dead. And he did. And they hauled him out to bury him. And as soon as the gravediggers came back in, his wife came in. And Peter asked her the same question. She told the same thing. She got the same thing. Drop dead. And they hauled her out and buried her. And Peter said, that was your property. You didn't owe anything to the Lord. You could have sold it and kept every single penny of it. Why did you lie to God? And that's what Peter asked him. Why did you lie to God? God is serious about our relationship with him. And he wants us to understand the perfection and the beauty and the wonder of his holiness. That's what we're up against. So when I read through these three chapters and remember what happened to Uzzah, and remember what happened to Aaron's sons, and remember what happened to the 70 guys here, I think it doesn't hurt me to be a little more careful, always, to try all the time, to try all the time. Do I fail? Yes, of course I fail. Fred?
The thing about Uzzah was he was not one of the priestly tribe. There was only certain people that were supposed to enter
right.
the ark. And he wasn't one of
part of the Levites.
Yeah, David got upset, but I think David realized later on, he had stuck to the obedience of what God wanted, who was supposed to be carrying that thing and how they were.
That wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
Right.
And so he, but you know, one of the things that strikes me about what we read here, what happened to the mice and the hemorrhoids?
They probably melted them down.
It doesn't really.
You mean the gold ones?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're nothing. Right.
And I guess they were put in the ark.
No.
No.
No, those couldn't go in the ark. They probably just melted them down. You know, who knows what happened to them.
The Philistines put them in the ark.
Yeah, but they didn't go in the ark. They're in a separate box, and they wouldn't have gone in the ark. No, no priest in his right mind would put them in the ark. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this day. And again, Lord, thank you for your word. And I pray, God, that you would help us to understand. That's a big portion tonight that we go through, Lord, but it's a good story. And there's probably lots of different things we could glean out of that. But I really, Father, want us to concentrate on worshiping you in your holiness every moment of every day that we're awake, and learning how we can give you the reverence that is due you as the Creator God of the universe, as the Father who sent his Son to worship you and to adore you. Thank you, Father, in Jesus' name. Amen.